This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. This is The Morning Run. I'm Melissa Idris with Kusu Chuang and Julian Ng. Ibrahim Saini is going to be speaking to the second finance minister on the breakfast grill today, Datuk Johari Abdul Ghani. So in the latest cabinet reshuffle, we saw Datuk Johari appointed the second finance minister after the resignation of Datuk Ahmad Husni Hanazla. And now we want to ask all the questions pertinent to ask the second finance minister. What is the ministry doing to streamline finances? 1MDB's future, where the government got it wrong, and overall, what the government's role in business is. So all that coming up on The Breakfast Grill. It's going to be a special extended Breakfast Grill. So if you miss any part of this interview, you can go to bfm.my/MOF to download the podcast. But getting back to business news of the day, several banks have reduced its interest rates for lending and deposit rates after Bank Negara cut the OPR last week. So far, we've got Bank Simpanan Nasional and Maybank, as well as CIMB Group.
Well, Bank Negara says that don't expect more. This is one of the preemptive cuts and more shouldn't be expected. And I think the entire banking industry is rallying around the new central bank governor on saying that this is the right kind of move.
Well, I'm not sure because the language of the Bank Negara statement from a few days ago actually provided a lot of leeway for more cuts later this year.
Because I thought Dato' Muhammad actually ruled that out.
Well, that's what he says now.
He said it was a preemptive measure. And how we want to read into that is, I think, kind of open to the market, right?
I think all bar one economists actually expected a second half easing policy. And the fact that Bank Negara actually preempted everybody and did it 30 basis points this early on, I think underlines how concerned they are about the economy. And the fact that Maybank, CIMB and BSN have responded so quickly, I think everybody's much more concerned about the growth economy than what they led on to, publicly at least.
Well, if you're worried about or if you are wondering about how this will impact your housing loans, according to TA Securities, a sensitivity analysis shows that for every 25 bips cut in interest rates, it will save your monthly repayment by 3%.
Okay, here's the thing, right? Q1 GDP in Malaysia has shrunk by, I think, at least four consecutive quarters in a row on a year-on-year basis, right? And will a 30 basis point cut by the Central Bank of Malaysia move the needle in terms of massaging domestic consumption? I don't think so. Our markets, our international markets are very, very weak already.
Don't think a one-off is enough. No, it should be an easing path.
There should be... people are saying that there should be another cut later this year, and they might even look at the property market in terms of easing lending guidelines.
Yeah, I think that if you look at anecdotal evidence, it's kind of palpable that the economy is slowing down and sentiment is not very
much.
In fact, there was a news on the Starbiz page 3 today that there's a downtrend seen in Grade A office rental from about 7 something per square foot. A new player coming into the market offering a deep discount of 5 ringgit per square foot, and these are Grade A top of the class office space, right?
So it's pretty telling. Within the next 2 or 3 years, we've got a whole bunch of square footage of commercial office space coming onto the market. So that's obviously another little barometer.
Well, Starbiz is reporting that former minister and banker Tan Sri Wahid Omar is expected to head PNB, Permodalan Nasional Berhad.
Yeah, this is interesting because he's going back. I mean, Tan Sri Wahid is circling the GLC's circuit, right? He does the GLC circuit. And of course, he's a top choice for it, having done very well.
He's got a proven CV. He's done Telecom Malaysia. He's done Maybank. He's done the minister in PM's department. And if he does go to PNB, as speculated, there's a lot of... Well, in the most positive way, there's a lot of damage you can do, in terms of invigorating the local economy. Because PNB's investee companies are among the who's who of the country. Right? You've got the Sime Darbys, the Maybanks of this world. And if he does a few M&As, there could be a lot of multiplier effects in there.
Yeah, this could be a good thing. Yeah.
This is a rumor, by the way. And
confirmed yet.
Yeah, judging from what the sources say, they think that things at PNB are getting a little bit sleepy because the top people over there, for example, Ahmad Saji, who's been the non-executive chairman for since time immemorial, and the other one, the CEO, Hamad Kamapia, he's been there for Forever as well, they say that Wahid should go in there to provide some zing to PNB. And I think this is really interesting because in his previous appointments, like being in Maybank and Telecom and as well as the government, it's kind of a very inclusive role, whereas PNB has a very specific role to raise the wealth of the Bumiputras.
So how is PNB's role different from that of Khazana, for instance?
Well, Khazana also holds strategic assets for the government. And I think that, for want of a better word, is actually more inclusive, right? It involves all Malaysians. But PNB has a very narrow view to really raise the status of the Bumiputra companies. And it'd be really very interesting to see what kind of ideas Wahid would inject into PNB.
Well, I mean, the numbers are quite stark because if you look at Khazana's assets under management, 150 billion ringgit, which is a B, but PNB is 225 billion, which is 75 billion more than Khazana. So, you know, if you think Khazana was a big hitter, you know, PNB is an even bigger hitter, right?
Yeah, but Khazana actually takes strategic stakes, whereas PNB, I'm not sure if they are doing that. Khazana actually, you know, does theme parks and, you know, ventures in
all
China.
All sorts of things.
Yeah, a lot of things.
Well, let's see whether this rumour, in fact, does turn out to be true, whether Wahid Omar will head PNB in the future, something we'll keep an eye on. Singapore's central bank is said to be scrutinising several banks to see if they broke anti-money laundering rules in handling transactions linked to 1MDB. Some of the banks that they're looking at include UBS and DBS.
Yeah, these DBS is a real major bank that's held by the Singapore government. So it's interesting that they're pointing fingers at DBS. I think that the signal that they want to send is very strong, that Singapore as a financial center with a lot of money there, you got to play by the rules if you want to do business there.
So there was always those rumors, or I guess, you know, reports in long form pieces in The New Yorker and Forbes, etc., saying Singapore was the new hub for private banking, right? So now, I mean, from the Swiss private banking side. So now is this Singapore's way of saying, look, we want to do everything above board, nothing dodgy?
Well, yes, that's the thing, because Switzerland is, you know, is the financial center of Europe, and Singapore is said to be it. And the opacity, murkiness of you know, such funds has always been questioned, especially in Switzerland. So Singapore, I think, doesn't want...
Remember the Swiss leaks, right?
Yeah, exactly. It wants to shed that image. And I find it quite staggering that Singapore has been so overtly proactive about addressing money laundering issues for their system, whereas in Malaysia, where we are said to be the source, has done
nothing, zilch.
Not much at all, right?
Yeah. So, but I'm just wondering whether if DBS can get away with just more than a slap on the wrist, because that's a bank that's being owned by the government, and you compare that to BSI, whose license was removed, then you see a real stark contrast between the two banks. But of course, you have to compare the crime which is being involved, because BSI directly laundered a lot of that money, apparently.
7:54 right now. Let's move over to the UK. Australia has now called for a free trade deal with Britain after its exit from the EU. So Theresa May says that this is very encouraging, and it insisted that it shows that a Brexit could work for Britain.
Well, yeah, this is fantastic because, Jules, you're looking at me. But, you know, the thing is, until the UK joined the Euro, and actually a couple hundred years ago, they had an empire, right? And that empire spanned the world. And it's very easy for the UK to call on those alliances now. If you look at it around the world, you've got Canada.
You think they aren't angry with UK? For colonizing them and for they created a lot of atrocities in India, for example.
I mean, you've had Russell Peters going on stage and say, "Well, you occupied us for 400 years. It's now our time to come and occupy you for 400 years, right?"
Well, so, what this says to me is that no one can afford not to have a trade agreement with the UK, right? So in the EU or not, countries are going to be looking at bilateral agreements in any case. Is this one step closer to Brexit?
I think Chuang is right in saying that Australia is very opportunistic. I think culturally,
absolutely,
they're very similar, and they're the first one to do that. But the other thing of what this shows is that the UK still has a lot of clout, in spite of everybody saying that the Brexit move is a bad move. I think for the fourth or fifth largest economy in the world, they are still in a position to do deals with a lot of people.
Of course, I mean, until the Scots and the Welsh decide to leave the UK, they're still the UK, and they've got the notion national combined GDP of something like $1.8 trillion. You know, unless you're, you know, got a couple of holes in the head, leaking your brains out, you want to do business with the UK,
you
right?
You know, on that note, I was reading that there could be a second referendum on Scottish independence by next year. So Nicola Sturgeon said that this could, in fact, they could trigger the formal process of having this second referendum put
in
place.
A couple of women are winners of the whole Brexit, because Theresa May and Nicola Sturgeon. All the others have been left by the wayside.
So Scotland voted to stay because they wanted that connection with EU. And perhaps Australia can do business with Scotland as well. Even I mean, it's a win-win for Australia, right? And they need to do it because they're so dependent on China. I think over the last few years, the UK has taken a back seat.
They've just come out of the most, you know, moribund elections, and they've got the winning coalition have got to really make a statement. And what better statement to make than doing a deal with one of their former empire owners?
Meanwhile, Mario Draghi, who is the head of the ECB over there in the EU, is asking governments to chip in to counter the Brexit fallout.
What? As in, like, pay into a fund?
Well, I think what the translation of that is that monetary policy has been maxed out. As we all know, interest rates have gone to zero and negative in many countries as well. So now he's urging for fiscal policy to play a bigger role in Europe. But, you know, they got to play by the rules, and every country has got to stick to that 3% limit of budget deficit to GDP. And if you look at all the European countries, not many of them have got a lot of leeway. I mean, look at France, 3.5% budget deficit to GDP. Italy, 2.5%. Spain is almost 4% deficit to GDP. Only Germany is in a surplus situation. Yeah. So Germany is the only country that really can carry out any form of respectable
fiscal spending. And you've got to ask yourself, why is it that Mario Draghi is wanting to do this? Because you've got a couple of other countries that are making, you know, serious noises about leaving the union, right? Like France and Italy, perhaps even the Dutch.
Actually, this is a good sell for the EU, because he's saying that governments are now in a position to spend their money. So that's a separate
the
issue.
The French are saying what money, the Italians are saying what money, the Spanish are saying
look
what
at the
money.
US. Look at US and Japan. You just need to turn on the printing machines, right?
That's not the solution to all. But speaking of the US and of powerful women, Hillary Clinton maintains a 5 percentage point lead over Donald Trump in the presidential race, despite the whole email scandal. So I guess now the Brexit vote over, the next storm cloud in the horizon is the US elections. And who will win that?
This is a landslide by any measure, because if you look at the few presidential elections, you're just talking about, you know, 1% or below kind of majority. So a landslide for Hillary Clinton, if this was translated to an election.
Well, if for nothing else, Hillary Clinton's manifesto is that much more clear than Donald Trump's. She's got very real issues on racism, on combating racism and the economy. Whereas when you compare that with Donald Trump's ideas on gun rules and immigration, and, you know, he's only got stuff on building walls and bringing jobs back from China. Yeah. So, you know, obviously she's got more clarity on that front.
Okay, the race will heat up over the following months. We'll keep an eye on that.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.